Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Gurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we'll start with Wyoming, talking about news of rare earths discovery that's created excitement in that state and beyond. If true, the discovery could help loosen China's grip on the market. For what it could mean for powering modern technology and more about China's stronghold in the industry, joining us now is David Madison, a reporter at Cowboy State Daily based in Wyoming. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Good morning.
To begin with, can you explain what rare earth minerals are? What did they find? What is in Wyoming?
Yeah, rare earth elements are these hard to pronounce elements on the periodic table that, when they're combined, are known as minerals. And the only one that I can pronounce with any confidence is gallium. I know that that's one that they have found near Ranchester, Wyoming. And they're necessary to create these really high-powered batteries that are used in everything from electric vehicles to fighter jets. And, you know, they're exclusively coming out of China and some other spots around the world. And Wyoming is trying to position itself as the solution to this supply chain problem that, as Energy Secretary Chris Wright said when he was visiting back in July in Ranchester, Wyoming, if it has a button, it probably needs rare earth. And we'll see if Wyoming can pull this off. There's several enterprises going on around the state, and I think it's really early stage. And, you know, investors and scientists and everyone keeping an eye on this is trying to sort the hype from reality. I think there's truly some deposits in the state. It's, you know, who can get up and running, who can refine them, and, you know, really create an industry to replace what China has done.
So were they looking for these rare earth elements in Wyoming, or did they happen upon it while they were mining for something else?
It depends on which location. There's probably about, I think there's about four or five areas in Wyoming that have known rare earth deposits. The one that's gotten the most press is Ramaco near Ranchester. It's in northern Wyoming. And it has a great story. You know, a guy from Kentucky goes out to Wyoming, buys a coal mine that he was, you know, he still wants to, his name is Randall Atkins. He still wants to use coal to create things like graphite and basically non-traditional, non-thermal uses for coal. And so he bought this coal mine north of Sheridan and sent some samples to the Oak Ridge Lab in Tennessee, which is part of the Department of Energy. And they came back and said, well, it looks like you've got really high concentrations of some of these rare earths that this country needs and would like to create a domestic supply for. And so if that's true, then it was a great purchase. Not only is there, I think, going to be an increasing market for non-thermal coal, which is something he's trying to position his company around. He has a separate company called Ramaco Carbon or a subsidiary. But it also could become a supplier to these military contractors and other really high-tech manufacturers that need these elements. And so we'll see if that story works out. There's definitely some skeptics around that haven't seen enough data and analysis to believe that it's as big a deposit as the company claims it is. But there's a lot of interest. You know, it is truly the first rare earth mine to open in 70 years in the U.S. And alongside it, you know, there's, like I said, about three or four other going concerns in Wyoming that want to compete in this space.
So Ramaco, who operates the mine you were just talking about, believes that they're calling it the largest unconventional rare earth deposit in the U.S. What do they mean by unconventional?
Oh boy, all right, let me think about that. It's in my reporting, and I'm not grasping it right now. It's the I think that that they weren't going for it, right? Like it wasn't, they didn't open it as a rare earth mine.
Oh, I see. That they happened upon it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a distinction I should have it at the top of my mind, but yeah, it's these are such, I think there's such a demand, and let me just go over all the different ways that they're looking for rare earths. The one that really struck me was that they're doing these flights now, low elevation flights over northeast Wyoming, and they use a thing called a magnetometer, which can measure the magnetism coming out of the earth. And based on that, they can narrow down where they will want to find, where they think they can find rare earths. And so there's all kinds of, and then there's another open pit mine, I think, going in near north of Cheyenne. And so they're all looking to fill this space, but the trick is figuring out, you know, are the concentrations high enough, and can you create a refining process that's economical and efficient and gets things to market?
So if true, and if they can get enough of this from Wyoming, we can divert some of our reliance with China. So do you think that the Trump administration is seeing this as a win right now? Because, are they really excited about this is what I'm asking.
Apparently. I mean, mm-hmm. It was quite a celebration there in Ranchester. It was a beautiful, it had been raining all morning and the sun came out, and out comes all of Wyoming's delegation, from the governor to our two senators and our one representative and the Secretary of Energy, who is a very energetic man. He got up and it was quite a political rally, really. He was flanked by these two podiums, I guess, kind of statues made of coal. And so it was both a pep rally for rare earth and for coal. And it certainly was being done in the name of the Trump administration. And so, yes, it's, you name the energy sector in Wyoming and it's full speed ahead. You know, I feel like I write the very similar stories where it's Trump administration announces fast track of this project. Trump administration, clears the way for this new mine. Like yesterday, I wrote about the expansion of coal mines in Wyoming. And so, yes, this fits right into that. And, we have, like I said, we have lots we're in the exploratory phase where they're trying to pinpoint where the concentrations, and then how do you extract, and then how do you refine? Because I think that's been the choke point, is that we've been able to mine rare earths in the U.S., but not have a lot of refining capacity. I think that there's one refinery in California, and that has been it. And I know that I wrote about another one trying to come online in Utah, where they're trying to retrofit a uranium mill in Blanding, Utah, to take on rare earth refining. And then up in northeast Wyoming, in the Bear Lodge area, there's another company that is talking, they're working, and they have a grant through the state of Wyoming to develop a mine and refinery right there on site. So yes, all of those things are being done at, in the name of capitalism. There's certainly mm-hmm. a lot of money pouring in. People see opportunity for profit, but also for national security. There's a lot of talk about net, winning the fight for creating a rare earth pipeline, a supply chain, was definitely couched in terms of as a national security priority, because they go into all this high tech, whether it's energy technology or defense technology.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about rare earth minerals possibly found in Wyoming with David Madison, reporter at Cowboy State Daily, based in Wyoming. So you mentioned the need for, so you need to actually extract it, then you need the refineries so that it can be put into a workable form. So if we don't, if we only have one working refinery in California, I mean, how long are we talking about before we can actually use these minerals that are found in Wyoming? Is it, is this years, or can they build a thing in a couple of months?
You know, I think that when you're talking about the refinery in Utah, I think it's pretty quick. I think it's not a big retrofit, but that we'll see. I think this the industry and the administration are trying to combine forces to go as fast as they can. So let's check in a year from now and see if, you know, see if it's really up and running. I get the sense that there's really nothing in their way, that there's lots of investment dollars coming in. The regulatory climate is really favorable. And so I'm not sure what would be slowing them down.
So do you know anything about the process of getting it from being in the ground into any electronic with a button, as you said? I know nothing about mineral processing.
Yeah, I can't. No, yeah. I can't explain that science. I know that I wrote a little explainer that, you know, there's three different types of ore and different types of ore, you know, the mineral ore that has lots of rare earths. Rare earths occur everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the trick is finding those concentrations that you can economically extract and then produce a rare metal from them. And so how that happens exactly, no, I mean, that's for a future story. I need to report that myself.
Well, yeah. So we'll talk to you in a year about all, you know, factories being, or manufacturing being built, and then you'll know all about this. You're going to become an expert, aren't you?
I did just get an invitation to go visit another mine. And so, yeah, it's a constant learning process. You know, the thing that's really attractive to industry is that Wyoming has a really strong workforce in this space. You know, that people can, the professionals can transition from coal mining or oil and gas or uranium and, you know, find a home with rare earth industries. I think you see that as part of the pitch people make about Wyoming is that it's the energy, it wants to be the energy state for the nation. And this fits into that because it's an extractive industry, and it, you know, will feed, you know, electric vehicles. And like I said, anything with a button needs mm-hmm. rare earth.
So you said that, you know, rare earth minerals are everywhere, but you have to find a concentration of it. So I guess, were we not looking for it, or could it be other places in the United States, or is this how you find it? You just like happen upon it?
Oh no, I don't think you just happen upon it. Like I said, they're doing these overflights trying to figure out how can they narrow down, you know, where it might be found. But there's an emphasis on looking in places where they may have been overlooked before. And the reason that we're doing it now, I think, is because the administration's made it a priority, and that up until now, it was just cheaper to continue buying from China. But if we see China as an adversary, then we don't want to be dependent. And this is the party line from the administration. We don't want to be dependent on a foreign country to have these rare earths when they're so vital to defense technologies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that. Like I just did a story this week where the USGS just released a report showing that this one geological structure under Southwest Wyoming was finally running out of oil after 100 years of tapping the Phosphoria rock formation. Maybe there's only 3 million barrels left, and that wasn't taken as bad news necessarily because there's a lot of other reserves around Wyoming. But in my reporting, I was told that the USGS is now moving on to studying that formation for rare earths. And I think that's probably happening at a greater rate because of all these executive orders and the emphasis from the administration on find us some deposits. And so whether it's in a coal mine in Ranchester or in an old oil field down in Southwest Wyoming, that's that's coming up. And I think that's probably happening with uranium too, that as you're extracting uranium, and which is really like that industry right now is just going gangbusters in Wyoming. I got to believe that they're also keeping an eye out as they're doing exploratory mining for uranium to see if there's other critical minerals. I think that's the kind of blanket term that covers both rare earth and uranium.
And I mean, if this was found in Wyoming, there have to, I'm sure that your neighboring states are all saying, oh, I bet it's here too. Do you see other states following on the coattails of Wyoming and trying to capitalize on this as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Utah is in a very similar situation. I've heard of exploratory work, and I think there's an existing mine in Florida. Absolutely. You know, Texas, you hear Texas and Wyoming mentioned in the same conversation sometimes. And again, I think we're in that exuberant phase where there's a lot of emphasis on it. And there's a lot of motivation to attract investors, and we need to let it mature and see what's real and, and can that supply chain really be established? And I mean, Wyoming is doing its best. It is, it has a remarkable university dedicated to extractive and energy industries. I mean, it is a that they work hand in hand with industry, and so it from my experience, it just feels like there's nothing holding them back. I mean, they have the not only the University of Wyoming and its you know, it's really kind of a top of their field group of professionals assisting industry. You also have just next door in Eastern Idaho, you have the Idaho National Lab. And I know that they have provided assistance to the rare earth industry as well to, you know, test the technologies needed to extract and to refine.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time, and also good luck with learning more about how to pronounce and understand all these earth elements.
Yeah.
So,
I'm learning every day. You can read more at cowboystatedaily.com.
All right. That was David Madison, a reporter for Cowboy State Daily based in Wyoming. David, thanks for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the popular Tea app, which allows women to spill about dating experiences and raise red flags about men. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. An app was recently released called Tea, T-E-A. The purpose of the app was to create a space for women to run background checks, identify catfishing, and check for criminal history for the men they are dating. The app sparked heavy controversy and was even recently hacked, leaving many women's information compromised. Joining us now is psychotherapist and the female founder of Awake Therapy, Jordan Travers. She specializes in helping clients build better relationships. Welcome to All Sides, Jordan.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by explaining the Tea app. So it gets its name from the idea, you know, the phrase spill the tea, meaning gossip about someone. Can you give us a quick rundown? How does the app work?
So it's an app essentially where women can go and share information on men that they've dated or had relationships with. So other women who might potentially have a date lined up with this gentleman, with this man, can get information on them before actually having that encounter.
Is it regionalized? So we're looking at, like, I can look at men in Columbus versus like seeing men from all over the country?
So I've actually never played around with the app. I mean, it's seductive, really, this idea that I can go on an app and avoid kind of the pain and headaches of dating. But, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? So this idea that I can just run a background check or get information that's perhaps inaccurate on someone before making that date, going on that date, I should say, it's much more harmful than I think most people consider.
Yeah, in a recent article that you worked with CNBC on, you were not a huge proponent of this app. So tell us more about why you do not like it.
Sure. So on a deeper level, what it does is it makes people question themselves, right? Do I even have the capability or the capacity to make decisions regarding my intimate life relationship without needing to crowdsource? It's very seductive. Like I said, this idea that I can avoid the pain and rejection I might experience or feel when going on a date. But those are critically important experiences for us. Those are internal alarms for us on, okay, is this something that I want to pursue? Do I maybe need to pause and think about this some more? Or are we even a good fit or match for one another? And I also think there's a middle path here that you can, if you're curious, you don't need to crowdsource necessarily, but why don't you ask a trusted group of friends whose opinions you value first before going to the end of the opposite end, right? A much more extreme option.
So the app is called Tea, which I meant is like spilling the tea, which is synonymous with gossiping. An NPR article said that the app attempted to harvest the power of gossip and leverage it to make dating safer. So do you think the app is a place for gossip and drama to spread rather than, I mean, can it create a safer place for women?
I think that some light vetting is important. I'm not saying to just completely, you know, ignore some safeguards, things like Googling a person to make sure they're legitimate, meeting in a public and open space and not sharing your address or other personal information, right? That's important, but there's no validity, right? There's no safeguard in place. Any person can go on this app and essentially say whatever they want about this person. And we know through years of research that any information, right, you can prime a group, right? I'm going to give you information about someone, whether that's accurate or not. And now you're automatically going to be entering this date, trying to determine whether the information you heard was true or wasn't. And it robs us of the most critical component of dating, which is emotional risk, right? We have to give ourselves the risk of putting ourselves out there and meeting someone and having that experience, that opportunity.
Now, some men are upset about this app because they feel like they're being attacked. Some said they were being falsely accused of things. Do you think that those claims from these men are valid?
I would agree. I mean, if there's no way to check, right? No way of interaction. You can essentially go on this app and say whatever you want about a person. So it's almost like a Reddit board, more or less, or like 4chan, right? It's a place where you can go and just write what your thoughts and opinions and feelings are, but there's not necessarily any repercussion that you might experience if you're not sharing truthful, you know, information.
So there's also men saying they want to create the male equivalent of the app where they can rate women that they date. What do you think the public response would be to that?
I think there's just no need to be doing this, right? Like I think the bigger question is, what's the point? What's the purpose here, right? It's, we're saying that, okay, if the argument is we're creating an app to keep people safe, then by the logic then doesn't follow, right? We're just gonna create an app to do the same thing. Well, then you're both admitting that the goal isn't to keep people safe, it's to create a gossip column.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the new Tea app with psychotherapist and founder of Awake Therapy, Jordan Travers. Are you a proponent of dating apps in general?
So I think dating apps are risky. I'm in the sense that it's stressful enough, right? Swiping, receiving rejection, trying to facilitate communication, that's hard enough. And these businesses, right? I'm not saying that they're going out of their way to hurt people. I don't think they're necessarily propelled by malicious intent, but they are a business, and businesses operate and focus on the bottom line. So it's monetary, it's fiduciary, right? We need people to stay on the app, engage with it, interact with it. And if you meet someone, great. But if not, okay, now you're still a consumer. You're still a client of ours that we can still earn income. You know, that we're still getting money from. So I do think that there is some risk there. I don't think that they're trying to necessarily have you meet your person. And also, research has shown this too. The NIH and NIMH have done research on how just swiping and staying connected in front of a screen, what that does to us psychologically, right? So being curious, taking emotional risk, these are important elements and part of our humanity and something that we need and have to experience. And so this idea, it's a really provocative and seductive idea that we were going to take the pain away from dating for you. Well, when push comes to shove, that's not realistic. That's actually not happening. So we need to just have an honest conversation, an honest dialogue about what these apps are doing to us. We're feeling more disconnected and more isolated now than ever before.
Now, the T app was recently hacked, and although the app was anonymous for users, they still had to submit a photo. I'm not really sure why, but this means that many users' information was compromised. Do you feel like that was just bound to happen with this?
Of course, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it was inevitable. Of course it was going to happen, and now your personal information has also been, you know, leaked.
So are you familiar with, you might be familiar with this, it's from 2024, there was a public forum called Are We Dating the Same Guy? And it got a lot of attention. Are forums like that a better way maybe to report information?
Again, I think the question to ask ourselves is why? Like, why are we needing to create a forum to talk about guys that we've dated? What's motivating us to do that? And I think also, on an unconscious level, right? It's a deeper question of, am I using this app legitimately to just see if this guy has a history of dating? Or am I using this app because I don't trust myself and my own judgment and my own decision-making around relationships or partners I might be interested in?
I would have to think that using something like the T app or Are We Dating the Same Guy would skew a lot to the negative. And someone's not going to go on there and say, I just had the most amazing date. This is an amazing guy. You all should find him, right? Like, it's for the negative.
Right. Or maybe it's, I was dating this guy and we broke up and I'm still upset about it. And so, like, what's my motivation, right? I might make a false post or say horrible things and accurate things about a person out of feelings of jealousy and envy.
So what do you recommend rather than using dating apps? You're talking a lot about people focusing on their ability to have their own judgment about a person and to get to know someone. So how do you recommend people go about dating?
I think this also opens the door for the importance of a third space. Many of us just have two spaces, our home and where we work. And for some people, they work from home. So it's just one space. And we are mammals. And because of that, by design, we are biologically wired for connection. We are designed to make connections with other people. We are a social species. And so giving ourselves opportunity to go out and meet others, maybe that's going to the YMCA or your public library or going to a specific coffee shop or grocery store. Finding ways to interact with others is so deeply and critically important. And I would say start there. Maybe even explore interests or hobbies, join a club, a group, find a way to meet people who are interested in the same things you are, and just kind of open the door for more dialogue, for a natural connection to happen.
Intuition and judgment can only go so far, though. So, you know, how do you protect yourself from someone completely lying to you? Like, what's the alternative to background checking a partner before getting into a relationship?
I would say it's probably the same way our parents and grandparents did, right? I mean, this isn't the first time people are entering relationships. People have been in relationships for decades and eons before us. And so I think when you see something concerning, right, say something, talk to a trusted group of friends, maybe family, people who you value and trust. It's our relationships that bring us back to center. It's we all veer off track every now and then, but it's our relationships that keep us grounded. And so if you are curious, if you don't know if this is maybe the right person or partner, have dialogue with someone that you trust around that and about that. This idea that you're going to go on a forum or a gossip column or chat to have these questions answered, it just logically doesn't make sense. You're not even going to get the information you need by doing that. So set yourself up for success here.
Could you see a situation, though, where if you did find out something about a guy and he was lying to you the whole time, that information is worthy of reporting in some sort of way to protect other women? I mean, I guess what if it doesn't come to the point of a police report? What would you say about that?
Well, I would say you would talk to somebody about that. I mean, I think there's nuance there, right? What is the infraction? What is the offense that you feel has happened? What did they lie to you about? I think there's a lot of different avenues here. But again, trying to hide behind this veil that it's protective, right? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. You don't know what's gonna come of that. And I think it's best to hedge your bets and navigate safety for yourself versus trying to be a mouthpiece.
So bottom line, would you not recommend people use the T app?
I agreed. Yes, I would not recommend people using this app.
Okay. And would you recommend people use zero dating apps, or do you sometimes find some validity in them?
There's some validity in them for sure. I don't think you need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I think, you know, having a realistic appraisal of, well, why aren't you going out to meet people in the real world, in real life? That's an important conversation to have as well. Like, what is preventing you from having and creating meaningful relationships? I think that's the first question we need to be asking ourselves.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Jordan Travers, psychotherapist and female founder of Awake Therapy. Thank you for joining us, Jordan.
Thank you, Amy. It was a pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to talk about Instagram, which has added mapping, and Google's AI Gemini is depressed. That's coming up when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Tech Tuesday. Instagram recently added a map feature to their app, which can track the user's location and, if they wish, display it online. This feature isn't unheard of in social media, but many users are concerned about it violating their privacy and geographical anonymity. Joining us now is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So many Instagram users are disturbed by this new map feature, potentially giving strangers access to the location. Why did Instagram add a map?
So there are some competing services that have map related services that are kind of built in. Like Google Maps allows you to share, you know, photos from places that you've been and you know, kind of review places. Yelp has a very similar feature, and Snapchat has something that it calls the Snap Map, which allows you to add location data to it. The difference that you're going to find there is the map that you have for Instagram is really, really specific, by which I mean it will show you, pretty accurately, where the image was taken. And, you know, one of the things that is really common about Instagram's, features is that it appeals to quite a younger audience. There is certainly an Instagram Kids function, but as we had talked about quite recently, there, you know, kids are really good at finding ways around, the kind of parental features. So being able to post on Instagram proper allows them to include that image data and that location information, which just makes it, you know, a really great way to find where people are.
Do I have to opt in or opt out of the map feature?
This is an opt-in feature. However, the map function doesn't apply, just moving forward. So if you opt in, if you have location data added to any of your photos on Instagram, then there is a way to access some of that information through this map service. And that's kind of a detail that wasn't super well communicated, which is where a lot of the potential frustration there comes, is that you have to really be aware of public posts and stories that you have shared previously and whether you want that information to be a part of this map as well.
Oh, okay. So if I turn the map on, a picture I took 3 years ago will be a part of it as well. Is that what you mean?
Sort of. It gets kind of complicated because it all depends on whether you had location data shared in Instagram. So that is something that a lot of folks have no idea. Exactly. Yeah. So if you're using an iPhone or if you're using an Android phone, there are ways to go in and take a look at whether you are allowing Instagram to access location data to begin with, to see that information. Kind of a second step there is when you go to share a post on Instagram, there is a location function in that tool. So you can say, include my location or don't include my location. A lot of folks just kind of skip over it because it's not as important as how nice the picture is or the words that you've attached to go with it or what hashtag you're using. And so there are a lot of folks that have shared their location information kind of unknowingly, because it wasn't, kind of something that was immediately called out to them.
Hmm. All right, well, let's move on now to Gemini, because people are worried about Google's official AI, Gemini. They're worried that it is depressed, or at least they're complaining that Gemini is writing some rather depressing messages and being self-deprecating. So, Russell, what's this about? Can AI be sad?
No. So it's really important to kind of repeat early and often that the things that we call AI that are run by Google or OpenAI or Anthropic or any of these companies, these are not thinking machines. These are not programs that are capable of expressing genuine emotion. What each one of these does in order to seem more human to us is it adopts language, strongly felt opinions or emotions in order to help convey, in a way that we would find more comforting. This is one of the genuine issues that we see with folks that are in what are quickly being called AI relationships. Is that it's very much a one-sided street, not just because the information that is being provided to you isn't authentic, but because the AI is genuinely just kind of pulling from replies that it has saved from other users. So the idea that Gemini would be depressed, there are a couple of other examples where Gemini wasn't able to solve a problem. And so it just repeated, I'm a failure, I'm a disgrace, I'm a disgrace. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be allowed to continue doing this. This is something that Gemini has learned from its users. And so that language is something that it has either, you know, captured from one of the many sources that Google is able to get that information from, you know, is able to pull from conversations that that person has had with Gemini in order to use language that is appealing to the person using it.
So Google claims this is just a glitch and they're working to repair it. Is it a glitch, or are too many people feeding Gemini, I'm a failure, I'm a failure?
Yeah, so it's a little column A, a little column B. What Google has learned here is that Gemini is you know, imitating you know, personalities that make us uncomfortable. And so the glitch here is going in and making sure that that this kind of language isn't used again. This is kind of really similar to Gemini telling us that the way to get the perfect cheese pull on pizza is to add super glue. You know, the you know, this information came from a place that Google is now going to limit Gemini's ability to rely on. Maybe this was, you know, the popular, you know, free writing platform AO3 that this information came from. It's really not clear what the source was that would cause this. But the really important distinction here is that Gemini isn't actually depressed. Gemini is trying to find a way to express failure at solving a problem in a way that its very human audience would connect with. It just got it wrong in this instance, because this is all still very new stuff.
All right. So do we need to, this kind of makes me a little bit worried about AI, but I guess, you know, there's always worry. There's going to be worries about AI for the rest of our lives, isn't there?
I suspect that, you know, some version of that will likely be the case. Yeah. But I think that in this one situation, I think the solution is to remember that this isn't actually a thinking, feeling machine.
Mm-hmm. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we are talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I want to switch gears and talk about Nintendo. So the launch of Nintendo Switch 2 was highly anticipated, and now it's here. But now there are also some worries. There's no shortage on sales, but the price tag has been driving many consumers off a little bit. So, and then recently Nintendo announced that they're raising the price on the original Switch and its hardware, and it alluded to a potential price increase for the Switch 2. So, Russell, in the CNET piece I read about this, it said that Nintendo is raising prices to react to the market. What does that mean? What are they reacting to?
You know, Nintendo isn't going to come out and like many companies, out of concern for repercussions, is unlikely to come out and say this is very specifically because of tariffs in the U.S. However, these prices are not increasing the same way in other countries. So the original Switch, the Switch Lite, and the accessories that go around them, they started seeing small price increases earlier this month. This is something that you can immediately see on Amazon and on Best Buy. In most cases, those price increases aren't more than, say, 10 to 15%. So if you're looking at a new power cord for your Switch or a controller, you know, the difference in price may be only a couple of dollars. And the Switch itself, you know, we'll see that increase. The Switch 2, you know, one of the biggest reasons that the price increase hasn't happened for that new console is that there's already a whole lot of them already in the U.S. Nintendo worked really hard over the last couple of months to make sure that the U.S. had a pretty significant supply, so that price increase isn't likely to come until much closer to holiday shopping season. But if you know, the current market conditions maintain the way that they are, it is entirely likely that what will end up being one of the most popular Christmas gifts of this year is going to be more expensive by the time we get to October and November.
All right, so people should buy it now and just save it in the closet for Christmas, maybe?
That is the most likely. If you know that that's a thing you're going to want to give as a gift, you know, there are a couple of different ways that you can do it without, you know, kind of increasing that, like, shopping anxiety, because it's not always in stock everywhere. Best Buy, for example, is really great if you use the Best Buy app at telling you when more is going to be in stock at a store near you. Or at a store that you have designated as your primary store within the app. And that way, you know, you can show up on the day that you know that more is going to be there, and you don't have to worry about kind of constantly refreshing a shopping page.
Are the games increasing in price?
We have not heard anything about games increasing in price. And I think a lot of that just comes down to most folks these days buy games digitally. And for the moment, there are no tariffs on digital purchases that would originate somewhere else.
Okay. For the moment. Okay. So who is it? They increased the price on the original Switch. Are people still buying the original Switch, or is it all about the Switch 2?
The Switch 2 is certainly the thing that is super popular, you know, but the original Switch is still a really great piece of hardware. It's a really great way for, you know, folks to play online across a great distance. You know, my girlfriend's parents have a Switch 2 and we regularly play games with them from across the country, you know, regardless of whether we have a Switch 1 or Switch 2, those games are, you know, cross-compatible in a lot of cases. So it's a kind of thing that, you know, is a great option for folks who want to save a little bit of money and still be able to play really great games. But the Switch 2, by the time we get to the end of this year, is almost assuredly going to be the kind of default that Nintendo is pushing forward.
That's what I was going to say. Are they still making the Switch 1, or is it just getting rid of stock?
No, they'll continue to make them for at least the next little while, if for any other reason than, you know, things like warranty replacements and stuff like that. Plus, Nintendo, more than other game consoles, just tends to have a longer shelf life. There are folks who will, you know, who will keep some of these in their boxes, you know, for 10 to 15 years, just like they did the original Game Boy. It's a you know, it's a unique, you know, kind of fandom compared to what you would get from Microsoft and Sony.
How have Switch 2 sales been? Do we know? Is it doing well?
It is one of the most popular consoles that Nintendo has ever released at this point in its life cycle. It has been tremendously popular. Nintendo has done a really great job making sure that the console is actually available to buy. It seems like early concerns about its price more or less evaporated as soon as it was available to make a purchase. You know, so it is definitely something that will continue to be extremely popular for the next couple of years.
And remind me again, I used to know this, how much more does the Switch 2 cost than the Switch 1?
You can get the Switch 2 starting at $400, which is actually right now, because of the price increase, almost the exact same price as the Switch 1, which was previously $50 less. You know, the classic Nintendo Switch that doesn't have as nice a screen, you know, was about $100 cheaper, and it's now going to be about $340. So the difference in price really is not particularly substantial for what it is that you're getting.
All right. Well, I don't want to run out of time, because this last topic that you sent to us is odd and funny. So Microsoft and the shoe company Crocs recently announced an unexpected partnership. They're producing what is called Clippy Crocs, which is a set of shoes with a sky background, a decorative replica of Clippy, the animated paperclip that Microsoft used to use as an office assistant years ago. Is this a partnership made in heaven, or one that no one wanted?
I suspect that, you know, there is this weird, you know, kind of subcategory of folks who really love the aesthetic from Windows XP. And so you'll find Microsoft
They want it on their feet. They love it so much.
They want it everywhere. It was 2 years ago, Microsoft released a set of ugly Christmas sweaters that were all Windows XP themed, that had a lot of that same, you know, classic background from Windows XP and had Clippy on the shoulder. And so this is very much in that vein. You know, these look like the background, the wallpaper from Windows XP, with a bunch of little, you know, accessories that you can embed in that look like the classic trash can and the mouse and Clippy and even the MSN butterfly, which I think was actually probably the less popular of those icons at the time. But yeah, these are surprisingly going to be $80, and they are expected to be available to purchase here within the next 30 days.
Did you say $80?
They are $80. They come with all of the accessories, but yes, that is an $80 set of Crocs that will certainly get people to look at you differently in the office.
So both Clippy and Crocs were both on Time Magazine's list of the 50 worst inventions. Do people just love to criticize these two products?
You know, I think Clippy has just become, you know, a novelty you bore out from our, you know, culture's endless quest for nostalgia. But Crocs have more, you know, not just been popular, but I've actually never known someone in the medical profession, specifically nurses, that haven't absolutely raved about how well they treat their feet on a 12-hour shift. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, they're certainly not going to, you know, take Paris Fashion Week by storm. But as far as them being actually functional, there are quite a few people who swear by them on a daily basis that do jobs that are much harder than mine. So I'm not going to criticize them.
Now, Microsoft and Crocs does seem like a random combination pairing. I don't know if Crocs, I'm sure, has partnered with a lot of different things. Do you think Microsoft came up with the idea or Crocs?
It would not surprise me to learn that Microsoft came up with these, but I know that Crocs, you know, they stay in the news by making sure that they have, you know, kind of quirky releases like this on a fairly regular basis. So given that Microsoft is about to celebrate its 50th year as a company, this really kind of seems like one of those opportunities that was probably too good to pass up.
Is Apple going to make some Crocs?
I rather doubt it, but it's certainly possible.
Okay. Well, do you see these Clippy Crocs selling well? Are they going to be a hot ticket Christmas item maybe?
I think very much like the ugly Christmas sweater that they released a couple of years ago, that this is going to be the kind of thing that we see, you know, kind of pockets of, especially in IT crowds or folks who just, you know, are looking to get a rise out of other people. You know, I don't know that this is on my holiday list, nor would I, you know, kind of add it for you know, too terribly many of my friends. But I definitely have a social circle broad enough that it would not surprise me if I saw them in person.
All right. Well, report back when you do, when you see them in the wild. That was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. And thank you so much, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you have to look up the photo so you can see what these Crocs look like that we've been talking about. And this has been All Sides Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News.